from the Young and Sober Home Group. Please get, help me give a warm welcome.
Thank you kindly, Jim. It is Jim, right? I didn't mess it up.
Yes.
I do that sometimes. I get people's names wrong, and I don't get corrected, and I feel so bad. Howdy, I'm Tyler, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tyler.
Thank you all for having me tonight. It's an honor and a privilege and a humbling experience to be asked to speak at an AA meeting. When I got sober, it was this weird, daunting world I was getting forcibly thrust into by the United States Navy. And they said, you're going to go to these things called AA meetings. I never really felt like it was really for me, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So I do have a sobriety date. August 4th, 2019 was the last day I thought it necessary to take a drink. I have a sponsor who knows he's my sponsor. I have the privilege, honor, and just overall great time of sponsoring other men in this program. I have a home group, Downtown Young and Sober, down in Norfolk, Thursday nights at 8. You had to be neither young nor sober to attend. We've had some people show up drunk, and those are the best meetings, tell you what. Most exciting. So my story starts in 1975 when my uncle passed away. I was not alive. But when my uncle passed away, my dad's older brother, my dad got to see firsthand what happens in Billings, Montana when a father gets to grieve his lost son. All of the men in the neighborhood and the family came over and asked my grandfather, Ray, are you okay? And there's only one correct answer to that question in Billings, Montana, 1975, and that's, yeah, I'm okay. That's the world my dad comes from. Because, you know, all the neighborhood got together and gave my grandmother food so she didn't have to cook, and they let her cry on her shoulder and grieve like a normal human. My dad was never raised with these things in his body called emotions, and so neither was I. So growing up, I felt these things called emotions, and I was told, that's wrong. You're not supposed to have those. I said, okay. How do I get rid of them? For years, I just kind of angered them down, because I was allowed to have anger. That was one of the appropriate emotions for a man. So 9 years old, I'm just full of anger. My parents divorced when I was young. My dad's a drunk. And I wonder why. And he did the best he could. He got full custody, was my long story. When I was a child, I acted out a lot. I was violent, even though I've always been the little dude. I have four older sisters, that tells you a lot. You know, when Sister A stole a bra from Sister B, you thought it was World War III, because they were screaming and yelling and pulling hair. But when they used toenail polish to paint my Hot Wheels, I wasn't allowed to fight back. So I'm getting all these mixed messages. So the point of the story is I'm confused my entire childhood, but I know I'm smart because I'm getting these things called good grades. But I don't get it. So I'm furious my entire childhood. And I turned 13 and my sisters gave me beer to be quiet about a party. They didn't want dad to find out about it. So I got this thing in my body called beer and it tastes bad. But my fists can unclench. I can feel a little tingliness in my lips. I know it's bad because I know my dad's drunk. I know he's done all this bad stuff because of drinking. I'm not going to be like him, but I'll just drink a little bit. So I'm already breaking my rules. But that's okay because I'm feeling better. And then I turned 14 and I puke on my dad's girlfriend's truck and I break a samurai sword. Long story. I have all these hilarious stories that I can sum up in a wonderful sentence or two. And it's fun. But this entire time, I'm learning this lesson over and over again. Trouble's not trouble if you can get out of it. And it's nothing that a drink can't help. I go through a bad breakup when I'm 16. Well, that's not that a drink can't help. I think about killing myself. Well, that's not that a drink can't help. I graduate high school when I'm 18, and I see the writing on the wall. My best friends are getting into gangs and drugs. Yes, there are gangs in Billings, Montana. It's worse now than it was back then. But I enlist. Because my other best friend enlisted, and he says, hey, if you sign up, I'll get an automatic promotion. The recruiter says, you're going to make all this money. You'll be a higher rank than me when you come back in a year. And I said, I got no other options, really. This sounds like the best plan. And so when I'm 18, I stopped smoking weed because it wasn't a big deal, even though I smoked weed like an alcoholic, but I put it down without a problem when I enlisted. And I didn't really drink too much. I built up a little energy drinking here and there when I was in the Navy, but not too much. I drank a lot back in high school. But then I go through another bad breakup and life's all over again, because that's how it works. And I start drinking more. I turn 21, and that's where my drinking really accelerates. So I'm in the Navy. I go from being a student to being an instructor before I even go to sea. And I learned that if I have a bad day, I can just get drunk. And if I have a good day, I can make it even better. And so my drinking goes from too much that one time to too much Saturday to too much every day, pretty quickly. I became a daily drinker right off the bat, as soon as I could. And my grandmother, who raised me almost as much as my dad or SpongeBob, when she passed away when I was 22, I took it hard. Everybody in my family took it hard. She was Jesus' older sister. She was a saint. I heard her curse one time. That's a fun story, but I'm not going to get into it. When she passed, everybody in my family at the funeral was all sorts of messed up. And I'm not just drinking. My dad got in a fight with my cousin, cracked his head open. I was too drunk to drive to the hospital. 4 blocks away. And I turned to my cousin, Melanie, and I said, "Cousin Melanie, I'm drinking way too much. And I'm only 22. Like, my dad's a drunk, but he's, you know, in his 50s. He's allowed to be a drunk in your 50s, right?" And she says, just stick to beer. And I said, "Okay, I'll try that." I kind of knew that was a bunch of BS. A few months later, I went to this show down in San Diego. I told my boss I was in Montana. I don't know why I thought it'd be a good idea to lie. I'm an honest guy. I think I am. And long story short, I puked on a cop. It's a wonderful story, but you guys already know how to drink, so I'm not going to tell you the story. And I wake up in the hospital, and it looks like I insulted the nurse's mother. You know, this giant, brawling Hispanic dude. I thought he was going to fight me. So the first words out of my mouth when I woke up were, "I'm sorry. I don't know what I'm apologizing for." And he says, "Yeah, you should be." My next words were, "Where am I?" Turns out I was in the Balboa Hospital. They saw the military ID in my pocket. The last thing I remember the night before was that the bar was blue. They're like, "Had some blue lights." That's all I remember. That very same day, I get out of the hospital. My buddy had to come break me out. It's a whole story. But that same night, those same friends I was with, I'm going to curse one time, I'm sorry. They called me bitch liver, handed me a cocktail, and said, "Screw you guys, too." I didn't say screw you guys. I said something worse. And I drank it. Puking down a cop at 22 doesn't really make me an alcoholic, I don't think. That makes me an idiot. I had a bad night. Drinking the next day when I know it's bad, I know I'm going to get in a whole heap of trouble. Maybe that makes me an alcoholic. I'm not quite sure. Because of that, I get sent to this thing called rehab. It's called Impact. It's a 5-day course. And I went to one AA meeting. Everybody else in the class was getting kicked out of the Navy for underage drinking or doing drugs or whatever. I was the only person in there besides maybe one other guy that wasn't getting kicked out. I didn't even lose my rank. But I went to this one meeting in Groton, Connecticut. It was snowy, and it was in a church kind of like this one. And some old lady was on a little stage talking about how much meth she used to do, but at least I'm sober today. My kids don't want to talk to me, blah, 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 blah. She goes on and on and on. All I hear is, it works for those people. And this old guy handed me a list of meetings in the area. He says, "Hey, you're welcome at any one of these." I said, "Hey, thanks. Can you sign my thing?" And he signed it. My first taste of AA was, it's nice. It works for those people. They're welcoming. Cool. I left. And I kept drinking. Or maybe I lasted a week. I don't know. I didn't really want to stop drinking. I didn't know what I wanted. I had no aim in life. So I resumed drinking for a couple of years. My life sucks, everything sucks, and for whatever reason, I just think it's a good idea to start drinking like every day. I'm talking drinking. I'm not talking 6-pack, 1 to 3 drinks a day. I'm talking 12 packs. I'm talking 30 racks. I'm talking liquor. I'm talking, you guys know. I'm talking, I'm still drunk the next morning, but I drive to work anyway. I did that a couple times. So I got orders to Norfolk a couple years after that, and I'm 23, 24, and I'm now I'm on my own. I had a roommate, but now I don't have a roommate anymore. Now I'm drinking just whenever I want, however much I want. And I go on deployment 2018, and I'm doing these things like having consequences and not living up to the basic expectations, like show up to work on time. I'm operating a nuclear submarine drunk. I've done engineering startups drunk. I've done engineering shutdowns drunk. I fought fires drunk. That's a lie. I don't think I've done that. But I've done a lot of drills. Still drunk from the night before. I never really drank in the morning. Once or twice I drank in the morning, but I never really needed to. My drinking didn't look like that. Well, when I was 25, I moved from one apartment to another, then the lease ran out, nothing tragic. My buddy and I got beer and pizza. That's like the standard fare for moving, right? Became whiskey, because I haven't seen him in a while. And I wake up the next morning, I make it to work. I don't remember going to bed. And the standard operating procedure on a submarine on the weekends is you breathalyze every sailor on board. I blew a .189 at 6:30 in the morning. I felt fine. I felt 2 out of 10 hungover. I felt A-OK. I was ready to take the first watch. So when I get told, hey, we're going to call somebody in. You're going to go home when you sober up. I didn't sober up until 1 p.m. I got there at 6. I was humiliated. I've been humiliated many, many, many times before, but this time was just that much worse. Because it was 100% my fault. I couldn't blame anybody else. I knew it was me. And so the first time when I puked on a cop, I got to go to this thing called a disciplinary review board. I got yelled at. In a room about this size, and the nice carpet, the nice oak tables. Everybody's got gold on their chest, and they're all looking at me, asking me these hard-hitting questions like, why don't you just try not drinking? Back then I said, I don't know. I need help. I have a problem. I said those words to get out of trouble. There's a fire underneath me, and I just wanted, because trouble's not trouble if you get out of it, right? And that's what got me to the rehab, and I kept my rank and all that. But when I get to this new place, I'm on a first-hand basis with everybody in the room. The room is about the size of this table. Imagine 10 people sitting around this table. That's not going to do well on the recording. I just realized that. That's okay. And they're asking me these hard-hitting questions like, what's going on with you at home? Are you okay? Are things, like, do you need to talk to a therapist or something? And I said, I don't know. I have a problem and I need help. I don't know what compelled me to say that. I'll never forget it. Maybe I was trying to get out of trouble, but what had happened was, for the next couple days, I kept my promise to not drink. So I got, for those keeping score, I showed up to work on a Saturday morning drunk. I got yelled at on Monday. I didn't drink Sunday. And I'm drinking again on Wednesday. I don't know why I thought it was a good idea. I don't know what's going through my head. There was no defense. I said, I will not do this. I'm doing it. It would have been easy if it was something like, hey, I will not chew gum for a week. But no, for me, I had no defense. I meant it when I said I wasn't going to do it. And then here I am drinking again. And so for a week or two, it was like that. I didn't want to drink, but I drank anyway. And then I went, the same guy that helped me move, I went to go to a concert with him. And we had an agreement. I could have we could both have 2 drinks each at the show. And then we could drive home from Baltimore, about a 4-hour drive. And the show was awesome, I'm not going to lie to you. And I had a great time. But when I sit back in the car, I remember my bar tab was 7 beers and about a dozen yellow shots. I don't know how many. I paid cash. The bartender was pretty. But I'm 2 years older and 2 ranks higher than the driver. By any metric, I should be the man in the situation. But no, I can't keep my word when I mean it. I'm lying, even though I'm telling the truth. And I realize I don't drink like other people. That was my last drink. August 4th, 2019, we're driving home. I get home, I go back to work, and I'm done drinking, I know it. And everything sucks that much worse. I had suicidal ideations up to that point, but here I am putting the gun to my head every single night. I've done it a couple times drunk, but here I am doing it sober. And I could tell you in vivid detail the exact sound. I'm not going to bore you guys with the details, but I for about 3 months, it was like that. I wrote a suicide note. I deleted it because if you're going to write a suicide note, I thought I should do pen and paper. Got to do it right. But I went to go put the pen to the paper. I was like, I can't do this. And I chickened out. So for 3 months, I lived like that. For 3 months, I didn't drink, and my life got worse. That's what makes me an alcoholic, in my mind. After 3 months, I finally get to do this thing called SARP. I get this interview, and they determine, yes, I do need level 3. And the reason why they said that was I was honest. On this form, I marked yes. On the form that says, are you going to kill yourself or kill anybody else? I had been working all night prior, and I forgot to lie to the doctors. Anybody ever lie to a doctor? Why do you lie to it? They have no reason to harm you. A doctor takes an oath and says, I will do my utmost to help patients as much as I can. I don't lie to the mechanic when my car check engine light comes on or starts making a funny noise. I must care about my car more than I care about myself. But here I am. I honestly marked, are you going to kill yourself? Yes. I forgot to lie. On all my paperwork prior to this, because I was in the Navy, right? So I had to fill a lot of paperwork about, you know, standard health batteries, yada, yada. And any time that I marked how much I drink, it was always 1 to 3 drinks a night. That's the normal answer. Today I marked yes on are you going to kill yourself? So a pretty large jump. And I was confused why I was going to the ER. I thought, I'm not bleeding. My legs work just fine. Why am I in a wheelchair? Why are you taking my boots? That pocket knife is special. Has my name on it. I better get that back. I never did. So I'm on the fifth floor of the Naval Hospital down in Portsmouth, and I realize, yeah, I'm in the psych ward because they took me here in a wheelchair. And it took them 5 tries to do the IV for fluid. That sucked. But I, over the weekend there, I got to talk with a doctor, and he said, son, I think he called me son, maybe I'm making that up, but for the story, I'm going to keep it in there. Son, regular people don't want to kill themselves. And I laughed and said, you know what, you don't know what you're talking about. And he says, no, I very much do. I went to school for this, and I've been doing this for a long time. And I said, oh, so you're saying I'm really depressed? He says, yes, one of the worst I've ever seen. And I was like, so he gave me a diagnosis of depression, which I didn't like that very much, and he gave me some medication to take, which I didn't like that very much, because both of those things disqualified me from submarines. I was first class, fully qualified. I was in, and that's what they told me. You're in. We want to keep you. You want to work. We want to work you, but you're a machine that's broken down. We're gonna take you out for maintenance, put you back together. You're gonna work better than ever. I hate it when they're right, because that's exactly what happened. So I ended up taking that medication. I had to agree to it, and it's called Wellbutrin. At page 134, it says, we are blessed with doctors. We would be fools not to utilize what they have to offer. So I got to go to this thing called rehab. It took me 3 days to realize rehab stood for rehab. The R in rehab stood for rehab. Substance Abuse Rehabilitation Program. And there, I got to spend 30 days off the boat, off duty, going to these stupid things called AA meetings every night, and I kept seeing the same people, I kept seeing, hearing the same stuff, and I kept feeling these stupid things I'm not supposed to have called feelings. What do? I'm going crazy. I'm 3 months sober, I'm going nuts. The third night there, I realized, yes, I am in rehab. Yes, I did just get out of the psych ward. It's all hitting me all at once. Because 3 months removed from a drink, I'm clear enough I can actually understand these things. And in rehab, I saw these people, and I was told they needed to get this thing called a sponsor. And he asked me these 3 questions. When I first off, I had to ask a grown man on a date. And I said, will you be my sponsor? I'm dramatizing, but it wasn't, not much. He laughed, and he says, of course, man. Are you an alcoholic? I said, I'm in rehab. He says, great. Are you willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol? I said, I got nothing better to do. I'm in rehab. He says, great. What time can you call me every day? I said, ooh, you know, the schedule's pretty grueling. I don't even get my phone in here. I can use the office phone, I guess. How's 4:30? Great. Call me every day at 4:30. So I got to call him every day at 4:30. That man saw me and cut through my BS. I was so full of pride. I used humor. I'm laughing up this entire time here. To cover my true feelings. Because when I'm laughing, I don't got to be genuine. My sister does it. My dad does it. It's a learned thing. Then in this stupid program called AA, I get to be what's called genuine. So I don't like that very much. Because I'm genuinely terrified all the time. I'm genuinely full of pride and anger all the time. I got to learn that. I got to learn that through this process called AA, called the 12 Steps. And the very first step, I admitted, I got a problem with drinking. I don't drink like other people. I already knew that. While that's unmanageable, I don't set my own schedule. Yeah, it's pretty unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power of goodness could restore us to sanity. One, I am insane, and it can restore me to sanity. Yes, I am insane. I get that. I kind of just said that. Can a higher power do it? I told my sponsor, I'm not so sure about that. But here I am, a few months off, at a rehab, working this after with him. And he says, I don't care. You're going to read the book. And I says, sure. Yes, sir. And I let this overweight man from Texas tell me to read a book. Does he know I know how to operate nuclear reactors? Anyway, so I read this book written in 1939 or whatever, and it doesn't make any damn sense. But it says in there, set aside your prejudice and what you think you know, and don't let that deter you from asking yourself what these spiritual terms mean. That's in the chapter Re-Agnostics. I was very much an atheist. It's not to me. I'm an atheist. Don't they know? Turns out Bill, he was a little more general. I read the word for the words, not the meaning. And sometime during that reading in that chapter, I said the phrase, I guess, out loud. No one was in the apartment. The sun shone brighter, and I felt warmer. I felt lighter. I felt the presence of God. I didn't recognize it at the time, but I had something called a spiritual experience. A very mild one. That was my very first spiritual experience. And since then, I have them every day all the time. But that day, I realized, yeah, maybe I'm not the Alpha and the Omega. Maybe I don't have to be so vain. Maybe I can just stop fighting this AA process and take what it has. And I told my sponsor that. He says, finally. All right. When are we going to meet for step three? I'm like, I don't know. When we worked it out. And so my process to coming through the steps was very much, I don't know, but you say it works. Let's do it. For those who don't know, that's how I define faith, is doing something even though I don't fully comprehend every facet of it. I have faith when I drive here and when I drive home that the other driver is not going to swerve and hit me. Well, I mean, I'm not driving, so maybe this guy's going to. I have faith. But I got to put work to that. I got to actually do my part and, you know, keep my hands at 10 and 2 and stay in the lane. So I'm working the steps with this man, and things are going pretty smoothly. I do this inventory. We do it pretty non-standard. We had this giant workbook. There's like 500 questions. It was grueling. And at this point, I get reinstated to full duty on my last boat in the Navy, and I'm trusted to show up to work every single day, and I do. I have some hiccups, but I get through it. And things are working out. What the book is talking about seems to be true, and I make these friends in this program. I got a home group, and I start doing things like make coffee, and all of a sudden, I just feel like life is livable. Before, what was changed? I was on a boat doing my job. Here I am. I'm on a boat, and I'm doing my job. What's different is here. I had changed mentally and in my spirit. I didn't even realize it. That's what this book does. It's insidious. It gets in you, and it helps you change whether you know it or not. On my own power, you know what it looks like? It looks like, no, I can't type a suicide note. That's my power. It's just misery and dwelling. And the 12 and 12, it talks about in the step four, we wallow in a bog of misery and take a perverse pleasure. That's pride in reverse. That's what I learned through my step work, through my inventories, was I am riddled with pride. I have this self-image of myself. I'm John Wayne, Bruce McClane, all rolled into one. Also, I'm qualified engine room supervisor. Also, I'm 6 feet tall. I have all these ideas for myself that I'm not living up to every single day. In this program, I take an inventory and I see that. And the best part about that is, in the following steps, I got to say, that's okay. I take the good stuff. I put the bad stuff on the to-go table, on the out basket, and then I let God take it. I don't know how to do that. I need a sponsor to help me figure that out. And how that goes for me is, I do the steps, I do the work, and I go to those people who have harmed, and I make those amends. And for me, that was hard. The very first one was easy. It was the guy that I called in off of duty to stand my watch. I said, hey, you remember the time I was a drunk jerk? Yeah, I'm sorry, and I'm not going to do it again because I'm sober today. I haven't talked to you in 2 years, but here I am. I know it's been a while, but I need to make things right. What does that look like? He was like, I didn't expect you to call me, ever, but I'm glad to hear you're doing all right, and have a good life. I felt like I had just bench pressed 500 pounds, man. I felt free. This one guy, I was such a, just, it was black and white what I did. I was a drunk jerk, and I screwed him over that day. And here I am, I get to make it right. Whatever that, you know, all I really did is make a phone call and express a sentiment. With other people, I had to actually do stuff, because that sucked. But I owe it to those people to never do that again. That's called a living amends. I didn't know what that meant, but you people showed me. Well, I'm going through this process, and unfortunately, my first sponsor ended up relapsing and dying. Same time, my cousin Kelly, who was like an uncle to me, he ended up relapsing. Oh, I guess he never really got sober. He didn't relapse. He just overdosed. But in a week span, I'm getting out of the Navy. I'm working 120 hours a week, shift work, putting the boat back together. And two of the strongest men in my life died. Addict deaths. When my first sponsor, Brett, relapsed, took him about 10 days. That's just waiting for me. If I live on this program, I can expect 10 days. That's the quickest I've ever seen. My roommate Donnie ended up relapsing 2 months after he got out of rehab and overdosing. I've heard many other people pay the ultimate price. They fought this thing to the bitter end. For me, this is a life and death disease, and I don't know how else I can fight it other than Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm my own power. Well, you already know where I'm going with that. So working the steps, I got a new sponsor, and I met this sponsor in the psych ward. Turns out it takes meetings into the Navy psych ward every month, and I happened to get him that Monday. And I recognized him at a meeting down in Norfolk, and he was the kind of guy that always talked about God. I mentioned I had a spiritual experience. I needed to further my spiritual condition and to actually work the rest of the steps. I didn't get to do all the steps with my first sponsor. And I asked this man to sponsor me, because he talked about God, and because he said, I can't do it without God's help, it being anything. He asked for God's help all the time. I didn't know you could do that. I knew you could pray whatever you wanted, really, but I didn't know how to do that. And so this man says, he just got out of a horrible medical situation, and his wife just died, and laundry list of stuff. And he says, I asked God for help through all of it, every single day. And I asked him to sponsor me because I needed to know how to do that. And so with them, I got through all the steps, and it was difficult, but it was the greatest thing I've ever done. And I commenced on the process of sponsoring other men in the program, and I have a great time of doing it. I met this guy named Jeff, and we're working on, I want to say step 10 or something. And we're reading before a meeting, and as we're reading, I relate what was read in the paragraph to what just happened in my life. See, this relates to my nephew being born dope sick and almost dying. Oh yeah, that just happened. For me, that I had called my mom earlier that day, and she told me my nephew was born dope sick and almost died. It took me 4 hours to comprehend the fact of what just happened. Turns out my sister, who was sober, relapsed, and the baby was born with fentanyl in his system. He almost died. It took hours for that fact really to hit me. And the point is, how I reacted was, I was floored, I was devastated. I felt all those emotions all at once. I shared about it at a meeting shortly afterwards. I got with my people, my friends, my support group in this AA program. I talked with my sponsor. I cried like a baby. And my sponsor asked me a very important question. He said, where's God in this? And with snot running down my mustache, I said, God help keep my nephew alive. God help keep my sister alive, wherever she is. God is all over it. God made it possible. That baby is alive today. He's alive and well. And that sister is sober today, by the grace of God. And I called my dad to check on him, and he was drunk. He had been sober for about 3 years. I didn't think he'd ever get sober. And when he got drunk again, it floored me. And halfway through the phone call, he says the phrase, well, I'm sure you're wondering why I drank again. And I said, I wasn't going to ask you, but yeah, why'd you drink? He says, because I wanted to. I said, Dad, thanks for not lying to me. If you said any other answer, I know you're going to be full of it. And then he says, wouldn't you want to? I thought about it for a good 5 seconds. I said, no. No, I would not. The call dropped. He went outside for a cigarette. It happens. It's something that I know happens. And during that brief window, I thought about drinking. I'm not joking. I got nauseous. It was a reaction. I didn't think about it. It just, my stomach started doing cartwheels. I thought I was going to puke. It was bad because I thought about drinking. But he called me back, and my stomach quieted down, and I was like, I was still kind of processing that. We finished the conversation, and that's my testimony. I've been through the test. That's my testimony. Based on the promises in the big book, based on going through these steps, I had a different reaction to life. But I was still drinking when that happened. That's a great excuse to get pissed drunk. I cursed again, sorry. That was my reaction to that. That was several years ago. I have another testimony to give. A gentleman got to speak here recently named Steve Soifer. If y'all didn't know, he passed away peacefully, fought 81 years old, 41 years sober. I was his caregiver. I was really close with him. I was his family in town. His family lives up in Richmond. And so when he needed help, he called me. And I remember it, October 7, 2023. Started the day with an AA picnic. You know, I burned 400 hot dogs and hamburgers with a 6-foot-tall transgender woman. Then I spent about 4 hours out in Newport News watching young people do stupid stuff like hit each other in the face with pies and do all this stupid, crazy stuff. Joe got shot in the butt with a paintball gun. Good times. And we're driving home, and I get a call from an ex-girlfriend who's in town, slinging crystal. She's selling rocks at a geology expo. But I love saying that. I love saying that. And she says, hey, we ought to meet up. I'm like, wait, we should. Remember, I said ex-girlfriend. And so we make plans, and I told her about my day, and she's like, yeah, that's great. Tell you what, I'll come to you. I says, yes, you should come to me. She's in Virginia Beach. I live in Norfolk. It's about, you know, a 35-minute drive-ish. She's out the oceanfront. And so I do that thing every bachelor does. I turn into the Tasmanian devil in reverse, and I start cleaning my apartment like there's no tomorrow. Or like there is a tomorrow. The metaphor breaks down. But I get a call halfway through the process, and it's Steve. And it sounds like he just swallowed a bag of gravel. He says, Tyler, I think I need to go to the emergency room. I said, okay, yeah, I'm there. I'm going to get my shoes on. I'll be there in 5 minutes. He said, no. I don't need to go right now. I said, Steve, you call me whenever you need to go to the ER. I don't care if it's 3 a.m. You call me whenever I will be there like that. He had lymphedema and throat cancer. His throat was swollen shut from a throat infection. He hadn't had anything to eat or drink all day. And so he was, you know, a man of 80 years old. He's survived cancer for 9 years at that point. He's feeling very weak. He needs to go to the ER. But he's convinced himself and he's convinced me that he doesn't need to go right now. So I'm like, okay. It'll work out. Girl's coming over. I'm going to hang out with Samantha. It's going to be great. And she comes over and it's great. And she makes a phone call. She's working at this geology expo. She calls her roommate at the hotel. Hey, should I come back tonight or am I good to come back in the morning? I'm like, yes, come on. Okay, I'll come back tonight. Okay, so I paid for the Uber, I got her home and all that stuff. And I tell my buddies about that, I'm laughing, and you know, I go to bed around midnight, had a lot of coffee that day, so I go to bed. I wake up to a phone call at 2:52 a.m. and I'm knocking on Steve Zor at, I wanna say 3:01. I ran about 2 red lights to get there and he's still packing a bag. I'm like, oh, okay. And we get to the ER, turns out, sure enough, you know, there's still complications. He gets a treatment he needs. He walks out of the hospital 2 days later, perfectly fine. What I don't tell, I'm sorry, I heard that an important detail on purpose, and the detail is, immediately after Steve called me the first time, you know, neighborhood at 9 p.m., I was overwhelmed. I had a long day, full of fun stuff, AA stuff, and here I am looking at what I want, and I'm thinking about what I really ought to do, and I don't know what to do right in this moment, so I just get on my knees and pray, because that's what I'm told people do in moments of great distress. So I get on my knees and I pray, and I don't even know what I'm praying for, and I just said, God, help me to be a good friend to Steve, a good friend to Samantha, and a good friend to myself. Help me do whatever I need to do. And help me to accept whatever outcomes that need to happen tonight. Or something like that. I can't remember the exact words. And when I got up, I felt rejuvenated. Like, all right. Then I went back to thinking about the girl. And looking back, I told my sponsor this, told my friends this. I gave my will and my life over the care of God. That's how I do it, practically. If I had my way, I would say, hey, you don't need to go back. We'll get you back in the morning. You don't got to call them. Don't worry. Don't call your roommate. I'll get you back in the morning. You can trust me. You can trust me. I would have got what I want. And I would put my phone on silence, and nobody would have interrupted me. Worst case scenario, I wouldn't have gotten that phone call, and I wouldn't have made it to Steve's place at 3:01 a.m., and I wouldn't. The story would be much different. I don't like to think about the outcome. I have 100 examples of very much minor stuff like that, where it's like, you know what, I don't know what to do, but God, you got it. I'll just do whatever feels right, because you're going to give me the direction, right? Right? Cool. This program taught me that. My sponsor taught me that. My sponsor taught me to have faith in a program greater than, in a power greater than myself. Also in the book, it says, faith without works is dead. What that means for me is, I can have all the faith I want, but until I do something with it, it's just a good idea. This program teaches me to take my good ideas and bring them into action. Things like take an inventory. I had another lady issue recently, and you know what I did? I took an inventory. I said, here's where I'm fearful, here's where I'm resentful, here's the why, but where am I at fault? I didn't know how to do that years ago. I learned how to do that with this program. I get to teach that to people. That's the biggest glory in this program, is I get to teach that to people. And I'll, how am I doing? I don't have my watch on me. How am I doing on time?
42.
Okay. I got time. So I'm gonna read one thing out of the book. And in my story, between my first and second sponsor, I didn't do all 12 steps. I did 8 steps, and I was ready to do my 9th, Memorial Day 2021. I called Brett, and he was drunk. Turns out he died 10 days later. So for about 6 months, I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't have the program because I realized the program doesn't work. I'm too busy for it anyway. I'll get back to it if and when I can. By a miracle, October 2021, I completed my contract. I got an honorable discharge. I should have got kicked out a couple times. But here I am today. I have an honorable discharge, I swear. And I got back. I went on a road trip. It's a better story than this one. But my second time in San Diego, I got to a meeting. First time there, if you guys remember, I picked on a cop. That's pretty significant. Shout out to the Meeting Finder app. That one saved my life. So I get done with the road. I go all around America. I come back from Texas and Alabama. Come back to Norfolk, and I get to a meeting. This is about Christmas time, 2021. That's when I get my new sponsor. I get back in the program. I was at this meeting down in Kent, and we were reading on page 25, there is a solution. So I'm just going to read the paragraph that we read that meeting. There is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of our shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, there was nothing left for us to do. There was nothing left for us but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. The great fact is this, It's just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences, asterisk, which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. Asterisk says, this is fully explained on Appendix 2. I'm going to briefly talk about everything I just read. There is a solution. I know this because I've seen it. Almost none of us like the self-searching leveling of our pride, the confession of our shortcomings. I sure didn't, but I did all that stuff previously. I knew I had done that. Which the process requires for a successful consummation. Consummation just means fulfillment. But we saw, we knew, we perceived, we saw the evidence. It really worked in others. This works. I wouldn't do it if it didn't work, if people didn't show me. And we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. My life got me in the psych ward. I knew I was hopeless. When, therefore, we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, you people, there was nothing left for us, the newcomer, but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. What the heck is a spiritual tool? You got a spiritual hammer? I didn't know what a spiritual tool was. A tool is any device that helps you accomplish a task, such as a hammer, a wrench, a screwdriver. I'm a mechanic in the Navy. I know these things. A spiritual tool is anything that can help you accomplish a spiritual task. Spiritual just means not of the human realm. So if I'm angry, if I'm fearful, if I'm living in self-centeredness, I have a tool called prayer, called being accountable, called taking an inventory, called talking to my sponsor, called calling another alcoholic, called deliberately practicing patience. Those are all things I can do. Those are all tools. You people showed me that every day. I didn't get it. For 2 years, I didn't get it. But you people, alcoholics, that have been recovered, lay this kit of spiritual tools at my feet and have found much of heaven and have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. My life today is so much different than how it was. I've been rocketed away from that awful pit of misery, and I'm in a whole new place. I'm still the same person. I still have my bad days. I'm still a depressed wreck sometimes. I still lie, cheat, and I do things I don't want to do. But sometimes, but now I recognize that. I stole a jar of pickles because I deserve it. And I lost sleep over it. I'm not joking. This is a whole story. Ben can tell you all about it. It's a good story. I'll tell you later. We've had deep and effective spiritual experiences. What the heck is a spiritual experience? I don't know. But in this book on page 567, which I'd never been to, but in this meeting, we did follow that asterisk. And we went to page 567 and we read this paragraph. The term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which, upon careful reading, shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. That's what I really need, is a personality change. It shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. I need to change my person. I can get with that. I'm a serving mechanic from Montana. I can comprehend the concept of a personality because I got one. I'm a serving mechanic from Montana. How many times have I said that? 5 times? I'm self-conscious about that now. But I can wrap my head around a personality change. Spiritual experience, spiritual awakening. You Christians are nice. I don't get it though. Luckily, the hoop through which I had to jump to get that spiritual experience is pretty big. And as soon as I said, I guess, I commenced on this way of life and through a very rocky road, and I'm telling y'all the exciting stories I can in an hour. Believe me, I have hundreds more. My life today is so much better than it was. And it's not perfect. I'm unemployed looking for a job. You know, I was Steve's caregiver, so my employer literally died. And I'm a bit aimless. But right now, I have faith that it'll be okay. And in the book, it talks about perfecting our spiritual condition. For me, I've read the book and I love it, and I live by it, as well, poorly. But for me, the next step is religion. And I'm not going to talk to you about religion other than a lot of people in the AA program say AA is enough, and maybe it is for them. For me, I thought I don't know what I'm doing. I tried church early on, and it was nice. I felt the light of the Spirit, but I didn't keep coming back. Recently, just this past Sunday, I went to the church for the first time. The same church where my home group is, Freemason Baptist Church. Because I met the pastor, I met the assistant pastor, I met the building manager. And their ethos was so attractive. because they do so much for the community. I said, you know what? AA does a lot for the community, but it's kind of narrow. It helps hopeless people like me recover through an altruistic program. That's amazing. The church is it helps everybody. So I've determined that's what's next for me in that regard. I'm going to keep coming back to AA because I'm still an alcoholic. I still need this. And for some reason, you people still want me. I love this program. I laugh so hard it hurts pretty much on a weekly basis. I hear some of those heinous, awful, amazing things from some of the most heinous, awful, amazing people. One of my favorite things about Alcoholics Anonymous is nobody walks in a saint. I've yet to meet somebody walk in because they think it's a good idea. Every single alcoholic that's ever recovered that I've ever met said, yes, I'm an alcoholic. My life is unmanageable. I need help. What do you do? Or some words to that effect. And I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for people like you in rooms like these. I'm a little emotional right now. Thank you. That's all I got. Let me share.